isoniazid preventive therapy. Now we will turn on to another important topic that is threatening TB control globally, which is the issue of multi-drug resistant TB and extensive drug resistant TB. To start us off this afternoon will be Kitty Lambreth from KNCV, who is the chair of the MDR-TB Working Group, and she will talk to us about the Global Response Plan. Please welcome Kitty. You have 20 minutes, and I would really appreciate if you could stick to 20 minutes.
Okay, excellent. I have to find... So how do I get... Can you instruct me how to get to my presentation?
Yeah, I think you click here.
Okay. What the, how does this work?
Let's see.
So there, one up. So go up one.
Okay.
Nope.
So it's
What's it called?
Is it this
that
one?
One. Kitty.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss the NDR-TB and XDR Global Response Plan. The title I got is What Does It Entail? Now, this morning already two speakers discussed the plan, so I changed the presentation a little bit and focus on how to implement rather than going over the whole plan. The contents of the presentation first... very quickly, the scale of the problem, why do we need this? A response plan, some key constraints to scale up MDR, TB and XDR management, what are the key elements of the plan, and I really would like to focus on the role of the STOP-TB partnership as a whole, but and the MDR-TB working group to really implement the plan. As we know, I'm going off this very quickly, we estimate to have about 400,000 newly MDR-TB cases every year. We know that in some countries where we have very good information, representative surveys, that the MDR-TB prevalence among new cases is extremely high. Just to take an example, Kazakhstan, 14% of new cases is diagnosed with MDR-TB. Now, more importantly, in that same country, there's a high proportion of retreatment cases among all cases. And among retreatment cases, over 50% is MDR-TB. Then XDR-TB. I'm not going into the details of the definition. I think most of us know. This is a list of countries where we have confirmed XDR cases. Some countries aren't there yet. For instance, Indonesia. We have confirmed XDR in Indonesia. Now, this is not really a surprise. I mean, the GLC has been established to prevent XDR. We knew it would come. Wherever you use second-line drugs without a rational regimens, you will create XDR. It's only now that we are diagnosing it that we can show this is really the case. We are, by inappropriate treatment of MDR-TB, we are creating XDR. The global MDR-TB, XDR, TB A response plan was launched in June of this year. It's a plan for 2007-2008, so 18 months only. And it has been aligned with the revised global plan. This has been explained this morning. Now, it really lists the main activities and sets milestones and also provides a budget for the coming 18 months. The main objectives of the global plan really is to have universal access to sound MDR-TB and XDR diagnosis and treatment by 2015. That means that the current plan is much more ambitious than the first global plan. And there's a focus on the 25 high-burden MDR-TB countries and to speed up, really, the scale-up of MDR-TB management within the context of TB control programs. So not in very small-scale pilots, but really to integrate the diagnosis and treatment within those programs. Now, the global response plan is not going into the technical aspects, is not really going into the rationale. It's more or less an operational plan. And the interesting thing is that the annexes show what needs to be done in the different regions. As such, it's a much more concrete plan than we have had before. Now, what are the main activities? First, we, and this has been stated several times today, and I'm just repeating it, it makes no sense to diagnose MDR-TB and to treat it if we don't close the tap of MDR-TB. We have, first of all, to prevent the development of MDR-TB. So, strengthening MDR-TB management, part of that is strengthening basic TB control, treat the susceptible cases with a regimen. The second activity, of course, is a scale up of the programmatic management of MDR-TB. This doesn't necessarily mean through the GLC. It means that countries diagnose and treat MDR-TB patients in concordance, in compliance with the international guidelines, with the latest, based on the latest evidence. The third main activity is to strengthen the lab services. I mean, we are not going to scale up if we don't diagnose. The first years we have been focusing on treatment, but we are not diagnosing. Lab is the main barrier even today, to scale up. And is also the main barrier to measure the magnitude of the problem. Still, some of the high-burden countries do not have reliable data on the magnitude of the MDR-TB problem. This slide is not to have a nice picture of myself. This slide is, first of all, to have something else as a text slide, but is to stress an issue which is now stressed also in the plan. It's infection control. This is a nurse infected with MDR-TB in an African hospital. She was the third nurse within 8 months to develop MDR-TB in the same hospital. They were not using masks. The nurses asked for masks, but the hospital authorities thought that was stigmatizing for the patients. They had a lot of windows, but the air was blowing into the corridors instead of outside. This is something which has to stop. It's scaring healthcare workers. It's causing death. And it's the health workers we need to deal with MDR-TB. So, introduce infection control, especially in high prevalence settings. Then another main activity is advocacy, communication and social mobilization. I'm putting bottom up and top down. I'm really convinced that apart from pushing health authorities to take action, the communities have to raise their voice to push from the bottom to make their health authorities do what they have to do. For that, we need money for all these actions, a resource, a mobilization, and to make MDR-TB management more effective and more easy, we need a research into new drugs, vaccines, and operational a research on how to facilitate scale-up. Now, what is the plan and what is the reality? Just an example. The annex of the plan states that by the end of 2007, in China, 8,000 MDR-TB cases should be treated within a programmatic context, and 696 XDR-TB cases. Indonesia, also 3,000 MDR-TB cases to be treated. The reality is that both countries have been approved by the GLC. In fact, very rapidly, with Indonesia within 4 months, China within 5 to 6 months. For the time being, there is no external quality controlled second-line DST to diagnose XDR, although it's part of the plan in those countries. Indonesia has been approved very recently. There are no DRS data yet for the country. Of course, the drugs have not been ordered. China, the drugs have been ordered. In the meantime, they're treating a lot of patients. They're treating more patients probably than are listed in this annex. The point is that they're not treated in a rational way, and this is not what we think, but which has been documented. So although we have the annex telling that we should have done it, a reality is that it's not yet the case. This is not to be pessimistic, it's the other way around. It's showing that we have to act, that we have to scale up even more rapidly than we have been doing and planning to do. Now, the key constraints are really interdependent. They all have to do with each other. In order to plan MDR-TB programs, we need data on the magnitude of the program. To have the data, we need EQA diagnostic capacity. I've been working the last 2 years in countries where it took 6 years to get one lab to perform EQA culture and DST. Lack of human resources. We can provide countries with equipment, with drugs, with all kinds of things, but the countries themselves have to take responsibility also to put appropriate human resources to make it work. There is a clear imbalance between the demand for technical capacity for technical assistance and the capacity to deliver that technical assistance in a comprehensive way. There is a crisis with the second-line drug. We are addressing that second-line drugs. We are addressing that crisis. There's a shortage. I'm not going into the background of the problem, but it's very clear that we cannot scale up if we don't have enough quality-assured second-line drugs. Political commitment, in the end, is a constraint which comes up in almost every country. Now, it's clear that we need one effort. We need to do it now. There's momentum. There's XDR momentum. If we don't act now, we are not going to do it in the next years. The working group, the Stop TB Partnership Working Group, is a forum to link all the stakeholders. This is essentially all of you. Everybody who is working in MDR-TB can be part of that overall Stop TB Partnership, a working group which includes countries, technical agencies, donors, etc., academic institutions. We had a meeting in Tbilisi, September 2007. Just for those who don't know, there's a core group, and the secretariat is with the World Health Organization. The subgroup is the Green Light Committee, is one of the subgroups, well known, I think. There is a new subgroup established on procurement, drug procurement, to address the causes of the second-line drug crisis. There is a very effective subgroup on a research, and ACSM is taken very seriously. We have three community representatives in the core group, which is not in the slide, very important. We had a subgroup, a very successful subgroup, on advocacy and resource mobilization, which was able to raise money for the GLC, and hopefully is going to be very active to raise some money to implement to be able to implement the global response plan. What role can a working group play? I will skip this slide, but it has to be clear that we need coordination. The only forum to have the coordination for really a comprehensive, coordinated effort is the working group. And the core group is supposed to really oversee and monitor the progress, to link the subgroups and to bring in the people to make it happen, and to launch new initiatives such as regional centers of excellence, and to initiate with the research group multi-center drug trials. Now, the GLC, there are a lot of misunderstandings about the GLC. Some people think it's some secret small group. It's not. It's in fact a large committee with a broad membership: MSF, the Union, WHO, academic institutes from Argentina, CDC, Partners in Health, Baltics, and KNCV. The review process is really very quick. Countries apply. We have six cycles a year. Countries apply and they get a response within 2 months. In fact, all countries will get supportive recommendations, technical assistance to get approved. There's only the only reason, in fact, not to get approval is if there's no basic TB control program. There are a lot of technical issues currently raised within the GLC and which are linked to a research group and will also result in adaptation of the guidelines. There are currently 48 countries approved by the GLC. 27 of them are supported by the Global Fund. The numbers are still very small because in most countries start with small pilot projects. Some countries would like, there is an issue whether countries should be forced to use GLC drugs. I don't think it's a matter of using GLC drugs. Countries can choose not to use GLC drugs as long as they're quality assured, and this is really the issue. Let's stick it. This has already been shown today. The procurement subgroup. This is a new group, and it's going to support the scale up by making sure that we have enough drugs. And there are currently no short, mid, and long term estimates. And that may sound very strange, but we don't know exactly how many drugs we will need in the near future. Clear is that we need more drugs on the market, and we need to pre-qualify those drugs. Without going into the details, very recently some important steps have been taken to address the second-line drug crisis and to show the power of the MDR-TB working group. GDF is currently facing some staffing problems. There will be secondments by partners within the MDR-TB working group, by MSF, Partners in Health, and the Tropical Disease Foundation, Mandela, to the GDF to help to resolve the crisis. Now, the research subgroup has been very active, came up with a new priority list for research based on the scale of barriers. It's a forum for partners to brainstorm, and let's skip to the next one. There are five areas, very important priority areas. So all of these subgroups are trying to take away barriers for scale-up. First is a lab, then treatment, programmatic issues, epidemiology, I'm sorry it's misspelled, and context. About diagnosis, we need to standardize second-line DST. We currently, not the working group, but the lab strengthening subgroup launched the second-line DST guidelines. There are a lot of issues to be addressed, to not only to scale up diagnosis, but make sure that we have accurate diagnosis. I won't go into the details, but that's what is planned. As for treatment, simplified regimens, we need new drugs. We have to look at the evidence of cross resistance for the fluoroquinolones and the choice of injectables. Programmatic aspects, treatment and adherence, infection control, we all need an evidence base for all these actions. Epidemiology, although it does not impress like a scale-up issue, it is. We have to understand why some regions are having high rates of NDR-TB and XDR-TB, whereas others don't. This is another important task for the research group. And then the preventive treatment of context of drug-resistant patients. Collaboration with the other working groups, the ACSM working group, HIV-AIDS working group, including the very important infection control subgroup, the Global Lab Initiative, find donors. In order to be able to realize this plan, we have to have all noses, I mean, this, I'm afraid this is a Dutch expression, but all noses in the same direction. Currently, programs are facing a lot of technical assistance missions, not always well coordinated. What we really need is priority countries themselves to acknowledge the need to move and to develop detailed country-specific operational plans, including the required technical assistance and the donor support. In addition, we cannot scale up without establishing regional centers of excellence. We cannot continue to send people from the Western Pacific region to Latvia. We have to establish those centers in the regions in order to be able to tailor the training and the field experience to the region's specific needs. We need sufficient funding for coordination of all these activities. It's not sexy to fund a working group. It's not sexy maybe to fund a research group. But I'm really convinced if we do not coordinate well, we'll waste money and we'll not end up with the results we are expecting from the global plan. What we need most, I think, is conviction that we can do it. I've been approached by several partners who say, we are not going to make it. Well, that may be true. Maybe it's too ambitious, but then at least try to do all we can to really put a maximum effort when it comes to collaboration, resources, country commitment, and then we can say, okay, we tried, but we didn't make it. But just saying this is too much, we cannot do it, I think, is not what we should be telling the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Katie, first for a brilliant presentation and two for taking only 5 minutes above what we had allocated to you. Now we turn to country experiences, and to do this, we will have a presentation from Russia, presented by Dr. Wislow, who is doing this presentation on behalf of Professor I hope I pronounced this correctly, Professor Erokin, who is the director of a WHO collaborating center. Please welcome.
Okay, I can help. So, good afternoon. I'm WHO TB coordinator in the Russia Federation, and in this presentation I'm going to reflect the current situation and efforts which are undertaken to address MDR and XDR situation. This presentation was prepared by our colleagues from Central TB Research Institute under the leadership of Professor Erokin and with support of WHO. I'm going to tell about epidemiological situation, the current situation and the efforts to make the data more relevant, MDR, XDR activities and response plan, activities which are addressing drug resistance survey, efforts to strengthen capacity both for laboratory but also institutions which are responsible for MDR control, human resource development plan and infectious control, which is obviously what Kitty mentioned, one of important aspect of good MDR control. In 2006, more than 24,000 patients were registered in Russia, among all registered, and above 4,000 new cases were registered. These data are routinely collected during the surveillance system, and based on this data, we are observing, let's say, steady trend and steady increase of MDR among new cases, among all cases. However, when we see such data from all regions from the Russia Federation, we see big differences among all pulmonary TB cases. MDR is in some regions above 60 or almost 60, in other regions is 2-3%. So it calls for the question whether the data are accurate, methodology is accurate, or other, let's say, reasons which are behind. When we analyze the data from Central TB Research Institute, which is one of the leading institutes responsible for MDR control, these data are not statistically significant as it is reference center, so most difficult cases are referred. And then also the number of such cases is not very high. But what we can see on this slide and also on this slide, it is really a situation which can we say that it's a serious situation. The spectrum of drug resistance among MDR patients in Central TB Research Institute is high against first-line drug like streptomycin, which are not used anymore in a regimen for in DOTS, but also we see quite substantially high resistance against second-line drugs. Of course, I would like to emphasize that it is a special cohort of patients, selected patients which are referred as patients to the Center of Excellence. Data from the regions where DOTS was implemented well, where quality of laboratory system is high, are also quite serious. So we see in one of the regions, XDR is almost 5%, and in other region where DOTS results are very good and treatment success rate is reaching almost WHO target, which is not such a common in Russia, is very high. But all patients in this region is not very high. So, and over the last years, overall number of patients decreased 2 times. So the pool of so-called chronic cases substantially decreased. So Russia is taking efforts for the last few years to address all this issue. So one of the most important is to update national guidelines on treatment of MDR patients based on recently updated international recommendations. Drug resistance survey is under implementation and would be expanded. There is a huge effort to strengthen laboratory services. Almost $60 million are in process to be spent to strengthen both microscopic culture at the federal and regional level. There is also efforts to strengthen capacity of the institutions. 5 centers of excellence with catching area of all 88 regions will be located in 5 institutes and 7 in 8 in the prison sector. These centers would be responsible for monitoring, supervision, but also for training, analyzing, and as a center of reference. There is also in the plan infectious control standards. This is now in the process of implementation, you would see later. But there is a big enthusiasm, and there is a lot of things which have been already undertaken. And the last, not least, very important, to implement a recording system, which will be complementary to recently revised national recording system, where we have very good, relevant data and accurate data on the situation of TB situation. The most important effort is to strengthen laboratory system and laboratory network. Russia has extensive laboratory network countrywide, but the most important now is to improve quality. In 2007, in addition to all efforts, there is a countrywide approved recommendation by the Minister of Health on training modules on microscopy and culture, which is very important because it is setting standard countrywide, and it would be possible to implement, which is ongoing process, quality assurance. In the framework of World Bank, almost 2,000 microscope centers have been re-equipped, and the same in the prison sector, about 600. 86 bacteriological laboratories in civilian and 65 in prison have been re-equipped, which means that every region has at least one good culture reference center. But the most important to improve is to improve quality. And we have started to organize good cooperation with supranational laboratories. The standard protocol was developed by our Russian colleagues in cooperation with 3 supranational laboratories from Germany, England and Sweden. So far have been performed about 3 rounds of proficiency testing, and the results are very encouraging. At least about 10 laboratories has international standards. So that is why in the round 4, the whole process would be organized inside country under the supervision of our supranational laboratories and WHO. In these 3 rounds participate altogether 20, 30, 40 laboratories respectively, and in the round 4, which will be completed in 2008, almost 120 laboratories will be involved, and most of these laboratories are involved on the voluntary basis, like countrywide quality assurance, which now cover more than 1,000 laboratories. The next step in next year is to include second-line drugs for drug accessibility testing. In this process are involved Federal Center of External Quality Assessment in Lab Medicine, which is performing outstanding job, the Institute Karolinska from Sweden, WHO headquarters, Euro and Russia, and it's really very good joint efforts. The goal is to evaluate quality of drug accessibility testing of selected laboratories, but also to identify those laboratories which can later on be reference center and can provide drug resistance survey and drug accessibility testing. The next step is to appoint network for external quality assurance for culture. And of course, the most important is to prepare lab to expand MDR treatment within GLC process, because treatment of MDR is ongoing process in Russia, also in many places. On this map, you will see how big efforts it is and how many laboratories are involved practically from the whole country. Far East is not very much involved so far. However, the quality of the data from the laboratory and performance of this laboratory and also future activities is very encouraging. As stated before, second-line drug resistance will be included in the round fifth. As a result of this process, we have selected, let's say, regions where performance and quality of laboratory is very high, and where we have been able to collect the data, and it is data which have been jointly analyzed with Russian colleagues and with our colleagues from headquarters. So we see that MDR in some oblasts, sometimes very good oblasts, where good process is very high, up to 30% among new cases, and is up to 60% among previously treated. So this serious situation is really called for urgent response. There is such a big interest among all regions to follow up international standards and expand, let's say, MDR according to international rules. 12 regions have been approved by GLC, so almost 4,500 patients would be treated from the funds which are guaranteed by the Global Fund. Almost 30 million are altogether in the round four, which can be spent on the MDR program. 9 regions applied, and many institutes applied also, and 10 other regions are ready to apply. So almost 7,500 patients have opportunity to be treated as the funds are guaranteed by Global Fund according to international standards. Another important aspect is human resources. In 2005-07, Federal TB Research Institute, Ministry of Justice, in cooperation with Partners in Health and WHO, provided 6 workshops on MDR for staff of all TB Research Institute, regional TB services, and TB services from prison. So it covers the whole country and all regions with almost 380 participants. The same process was with LAB, almost 345 participants during the 23 trainings. There is a great support from European WHO Collaborating Center in Riga, where our colleagues had opportunity to see how well trainings can be organized, and colleagues from Riga are coming also to Russia to support certain trainings, like it happens at the regional level, to train people how to prepare applications, how to train on MDR management. So in 2007, almost 72 participate in this process. In addition, Central TB Research Institute opened demonstration, let's say, training center as a branch of CTRI in Oriel. 2 other demonstration centers are planned for 2008-09. In 2008, additional training on MDR management will be organized, and we plan to train additional IT specialists. Infectious control is an ongoing process quite now dynamically. The thematic working group is a very effective, and the first material has been prepared, and we hope that very soon the new guidelines on infectious control following international standards will be approved. But so far, based on ad hoc prepared materials, training materials, guidelines, about 95 specialists have been trained from almost whole country, and the additional 55 will be trained or retrained in next 2 years. There is additional efforts to provide equipment, high-class equipment. As you see, the figures are quite impressive. Almost 2,000 safety cabinets first class, almost 500 sputum collection booths, individual respirators. People have to use how to do it, but these standards are gradually implemented and people are trained how to use it. These 30 centers I mentioned before, which will be established, have been equipped already in this infectious control equipment. The same 43 bacteriological laboratories are equipped as well, as there is a human crisis and people don't want to work. So this is one of the good steps to guarantee human, let's say, safety, so people are much easier, are working in the good conditions. What's the plan for next year? The first of all, what I mentioned, is to prepare new regulation on chemotherapy. We are now obliged to start treatment of almost 4,500 patients, at least in 20 regions. It's enormous efforts, and it calls for really mobilization of all, let's say, colleagues and all institutions. There is a plan to implement new revised recording reporting system in MDR. We have to expand surveillance as more laboratories are willing to support and donor also willing to support this process, including our colleagues from headquarters. And we have to increase operational research to learn about different factors, but also to learn how and why MDR is growing. Major challenges is restriction of use of second-line drugs, prolonged use. And the most painful, what Skitty said, there is a crisis of second-line drugs, but there is complex issues, many issues, which should be solved urgently. Having in mind what has been done since Tbilisi, I'm more optimistic. However, we should be very much focused on this aspect. Additional, let's say, more long-term approach is to promote GMP standards to increase provision of second-line drugs countrywide, but also to allow international factories to maybe move production to Russia. This process has been initiated 2 years ago. As of today, more than 9 factories are participating in this process. Mobilization of society and to sustain this momentum is also very challenging for next year. I would like to make conclusion that last year was difficult. There is no visible improvement. However, the first time death rate decreased almost 3%. But this increasing financial support from government, but also from many organizations and donors during last years, allows to improve the background, the foundation to improve TB, but also TB-HIV control. Growing number of MDR and XDR calls for urgent expansion of internationally accepted standards for MDR management and the call for everybody. Continuation of the Global Fund project is extremely important to accelerate the expansion of MDR management. And reliable mechanisms to ensure provision of WHO pre-qualified second-line drug should be also urgently requested. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for also a wonderful presentation and staying closely within time. We now have a few minutes for comments and questions. If I could ask the two presenters to please come up here so that you can receive questions from the audience. You heard about the Global Response Plan, and you've seen how that plan has been used very closely by the Russians. And we can have your question, please.
My name is Dr. Chekzai Khan from Pakistan. My question is from Madam Kitty, that she talked about MDR-TB, which is, of course, a very big problem in all the world. My request and my few words is regarding some recommendation from the Union, from WHO, and all international organizations to all the governments for uniformity in the medicine, in the purchase of medicine, and the supply of medicine where we find anti-TB drugs in the markets, which are of different strengths and different qualities. So if some type of recommendation goes from this August international organization to national governments regarding the uniformity in the medicine of anti-TB drugs, that is my proposal. Thank you very much.
We'll take about, if you remember all the questions, we'll take about 2 or 3 questions, and then we could ask the panel to respond. So, next one, please, and be precise and short so that we can have the chance to have a lot more people asking questions.
Thank you. My name is Jerry Friedland from Yale University in the U.S. and the Tegela Ferry Care and Research Collaboration in South Africa. This question is directed to both presenters with a similar theme. We recognize that in Russia, as well as in Africa, the growing HIV/AIDS epidemic is at least partially, maybe partially responsible for the rise in MDR/XDR cases. I didn't hear in the presentation any information about what is known about the seroprevalence of HIV among the MDR/XDR cases and how closely integrated these programs therefore must be. Similarly, for the larger global response plan, people have pointed out that among the best therapies that exist now for XDR tuberculosis is antiretroviral therapy rather than specific TB therapy. And I would like to hear your comments about further integration of TB and HIV antiretroviral treatment, not only surveillance and diagnosis of HIV, but actually treatment of those with MDR and XDR TB.
Thank you. There, please.
My name is Joost van der Meer. I'm from AIDS Foundation East West. We are a Dutch-based organization, but working in Russia and other countries of the former Soviet Union on HIV and also TB HIV issues. And I have a question for Dr. Yabukovic. Can you indicate what, in the plan for Russia, the role of civil society and NGOs is?
Last question before we have the presenters respond.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Dr. Ngende. I'm working at CISU Hospital. It's a center for MDR/XDR. I would like to learn from Russia experience. When the patient has been treated more than 12 months and the patient doesn't convert, what is the experience of Russia? This patient is declared a treatment failure in terms of infection control. The patient is going home or the patient will stay in the hospital, maybe until the patient will die. Thank you.
We now have Katie start off with the responses.
Yes, I'm not quite sure whether I got the first question right, but if I understand it well, you are concerned about the uncontrolled use of second-line drugs of unknown quality and what we can do to convince governments to control that. Is that right? Is that the issue? If that's your question, it's one of the actions which are prepared by the subgroup for drug procurement. And in fact, during the last board meeting of the coordinating board meeting in Berlin, one of the ministers who was from Malawi was in fact focusing on that issue and will erase the issue of country responsibility with regards to second-line drugs in the executive board of the World Health Organization. But I'm not sure I got the question right. First, the integration of ARV treatment and second-line treatment. This has been a neglected area in the guidelines. There is an HIV chapter in the current MDR-TB guidelines, but because of lack of experience, there were not really many details on interactions, for instance. Now, the guidelines are currently under a revision, and this is one of the chapters which will be or has been revised and will focus more on simultaneous use of ARVs and second-line drugs, interactions, etc. As far as the seroprevalence of HIV among MDR-TB and XDR cases is concerned, we do have data for certain countries, But in fact, the XDR data are really still very scarce. The slide I showed, the WHO slide, is just telling that from these countries we do have confirmed cases. There is no there are no representative XDR surveys, let alone XDR-TB surveys linked to HIV, at least not as far as I know. We have hospital data, but no clear overview. But of course we know which countries do have a high overlap between HIV and TB, and among them are countries with an evident MDR-TB problem, and what we can expect is a high overlap there. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for your questions. There are a couple of questions that we'll try to be brief. I didn't mention very much about HIV and TB. HIV is still is a not such urgent problem as MDR. However, the problem exists and is growing, so we didn't neglect this problem. As of today, more than 380,000 patients, the cases are registered with as HIV. Among these patients, about 90%, almost 90%, more than 90% TB patients are tested for HIV. And there is, under the Ministry of Health, a special group which are trying to develop, let's say, a good program for TB-HIV. I would invite for poster presentation where Dr. Frolova would make a presentation that will show the results, the progress, and the current situation. But we have in every region trained at least 2 times coordinator, and it really make big progress. For last 2 years, there is a new data collected, and the data are more accurate. As of today, we have about 9,000 TB-HIV patients. So the problem exists, is growing, and there are a couple of activities which are going to address this problem. About the NGO and program. So we are, of course, making from the very beginning a lot of efforts. There are not many NGOs registered in TB. There is the Russian Red Cross, and we have a close cooperation. There is a patient, one patient association, which are actively participating in many activities. But since Global Fund, we have a more and more cooperation with different NGOs which are focused on HIV. They are more and more interested, and in plan next round, it is a lot of activities which are which will be, let's say, addressed to them. One of the good examples of cooperation is Association of Journalists. We are organizing every year competition for journalists on the best work on TB. And also, they are organizing, let's say, for best work for patients and at the regional level. But there is much more to be done. That is why this aspect I put as a challenge for next year, and I know that all colleagues are very open for cooperation. Coming to the last question, there are different, let's say, of course, models, and we have to keep in mind when in Russia the patients, the typical profile of patient is quite difficult. The typical patient is 44 years old, living alone, without job, very often having, let's say, in prison history, and very often alcoholics. So that is why they're different, but we have a lot of experience, good experience, and a lot of publication on different social or incentive programs. In good regions, where at the beginning the default rate, for example, was about 20%, they are keeping default rate about 2-3%. We are changing, we are trying to modify, but we have certain standards which really can help, and we're ready to send. And there are different models, of course, in different regions because Russia is a federation. So it's a different culture, different nations, and, of course, different organization aspects.
Yes, please.
Thank you. I'm Joseph Oliambo, CDC in Kenya. I just wanted to ask about policy on initiation of MDR-TB treatment. I'm aware of settings where this is being done on outpatient ambulatory basis, while also there are settings who have not, which have not started MDR TB treatment because they are waiting for isolation facilities. Do we need isolation facilities, or MDR TB can also be treated as outpatient ambulatory basis?
Any of you?
We have in fact many GLC projects which have been approved, which have ambulatory treatment from the very beginning. It's not so much ambulatory versus hospitalization. What is key, whether the health health care for those patients ensures that patients have guidance, effective side effect management, that there's a defaulter tracing, just to summarize that there is effective management of those patients. And in some settings, you may even prefer to have ambulatory treatment because you may not want to have MDR, XDR, TB cases within the hospital. But so it's not necessary to have hospitalization as long as the ambulatory treatment is supervised by experienced and motivated staff.
If I would add, so it's a matter of how you are implementing different, let's say, infectious control standards. Institution standards are necessary where, let's say, there is a low culture and there is no such, let's say, behavior. So there is an environmental aspect. I can say that one of the examples is our region of Vladimir, where they have a perfect results, no single, let's say, in hospital disease of TB, nosocomial disease. In our region where they undertake, let's say, administration aspect also, they have perfect results, but it's a matter of different standard. Also, how to behave, how to protect yourself, and how to be protected. So all this complex issue depends on this, you have to make a measures. In my presentation, I mentioned that there will be, let's say, 13 centers of excellence. Each center of excellence will be well equipped with all, let's say, standards of infectious control, I mean, negative pressure, etc. So all these aspects have been taken into account and is in the process of implementation. So it will be, let's say, like 250 beds in civilian sector and also almost 200 in the prison sector.
Thank you. I don't see anybody wanting to ask a question. I think that's good because we are bang on time. And now we will move on the final session of this afternoon, which will deal with the issues of infection control. And my co-chair will manage that particular session. Thank you.
Thank you, Chikaya. So we'll now be proceeding to the last part of this afternoon session, which is an equally important aspect of TB management, and that is really looking into infection control. So may I call on Bess Miller from the USA TB-HIV Subgroup Chair on Infection Control.
I thought I had it.
There we go. Can you turn it up?
No. Yeah, there. Thanks. Thanks very much. I'm here representing the newly formed subgroup on TB infection control, part of the TB-HIV working group. And although my title, I think, was update on the guidelines, what I'd like to tell you about is the working group, some of the things that we've been doing and things that we plan to do. I'd like to begin by acknowledging a number of people who've done a tremendous amount of work in this area and also working on the area currently, and I'd like to particularly note Paul Jensen, who's done over the past number of years, sort of personally managed many of the infection control issues around the globe. and also Ed Nardell, Rose Prey, Jeroen van Gorkum, Karin Vier, Madhu Pai, Paul Nunn, Bill Coggan, and Christine Whalen. What lit the fire on infection control? It's not a new discovery, as we all know, but it's been around, and it's always something that we put on the back burner. And I think clearly there are certain things that set it off, and the outbreak in Tugela Ferry, I think, was one of the key elements in the most recent. And I think I won't go into the details of that, but a second factor was probably the air travel of a particular gentleman from my hometown of Atlanta, Georgia, who wanted to get married in Greece. So I think these were gifts to us, but that's what got this issue on the front burner. We first met at the union meeting in Paris last year, and then in November of this past year, the infection control subgroup was put under the TB-HIV working group, and I think Marcos Espinal this morning showed that, you know, one could formulate the groups in many different ways. It certainly interfaces with all of the working groups, and I think I'll try and mention that. The terms of reference of this subgroup are, as you see, initially to look at the 1999 guidelines and revise them. But we want to move from guidelines to action, and I think that would summarize the key point of this working group. So the next step, and we are currently working on a framework, which will be sort of a very terse document that will help countries develop action plans. We want to provide technical assistance and train up folks to be able to do that. Strengthen partnerships, and again, this is not just a general expression, but TB infection control has to be seen in the framework of general infection control, whether it's respiratory infection control, in some areas it's called occupational health, environmental health, but we can't just insert this in a program without being a part of a larger network in terms of sustainability. Of course, human resource capacity, promote advocacy and communication, get resources, identify research needs. Some of the folks in different subgroups and working groups, in thinking about who has the toughest road to hoe, and in some ways infection control, we've got limited evidence base for some of our strategies, and so we've got a lot of research needs. Just briefly, the group has consisted basically of an email group of about 50 folks, and we've been communicating over the past year. The first meeting of this subgroup was at the MDR-TB working group meeting in Tbilisi in September, and then we most recently had a TB infection control consultation in Geneva. And I would like to mention a bit about these two meetings and what we learned from these meetings and then how we're going to go forward. I won't go over these maps again, only to say that we're not only seeing MDR and MDR in previously untreated and in previously treated cases in, you know, certain spots and areas of the former Soviet Union and Russia and so on, but we're seeing them move into areas, Africa and other areas that have enormous rates of HIV seroprevalence, and so sort of a new era of concern. Countries with XDR-TB, again, we've all seen this, so this is moving into all regions. Here's an open ward. It's actually taken from a 1918 photo from the Spanish influenza outbreak. But similarly, in many areas, we know that there are open wards, and I put under here courtesy of Dr. Chauhan from India, who had a slide similar to this. You know, triaging, does anyone have a cough? It hardly passes the laugh test. It's almost, does anyone not have a cough in this room? And again, not only MDR, but again, HIV prevalence driving the increase in TB-HIV in Russia. So once again, these two areas, both MDR, HIV, high TB rates, HIV seroprevalence. And finally, the universal access to ARV by 2010, which is in an unprecedented way bringing immunocompromised persons into the healthcare system. So it's almost like a laboratory for TB transmission. The concerns we heard about infection control in Tbilisi were many. Of course, the main issue at the meeting was the acute shortage of second-line drugs, which has been discussed here already. But again, in terms of not being able to treat folks and allowing them to remain infectious, these are some key issues. TB suspects and patients in general medical wards, lab systems, again, a universal theme, I think, at this meeting and at the meeting at the union, underlying all of these issues. If there's poor diagnosis, there's continuing infectious tuberculosis cases. So all of these come back to basic dots. There's a lack of clarity about infection control guidelines. What are our priorities? I will not be discussing here, but the three basic strategies are administrative or work practice controls, environmental, and personal protection, including respiratory protection. Which should be first? Which should be, you know, what should we emphasize if we have only so many dollars? We don't have cost information on a lot of these, and so setting priorities is difficult, and we'll come back to that. Cost of infection control, lack of technical consultants. The next meeting was in Geneva, two-day meeting, October 22nd and 23rd. Here we had about 50 participants, including experts on infection control, country representation, engineering, ventilation, representation from the regions, the International Council of Nurses, the International Labor Organization, trying to bring in partners who are working in infection control from different avenues. We had plenary sessions and breakout sessions, which were very well attended, and a lot of important information came through. They were framed along what will be the framework, which is looking at policy issues, partnerships, the strategies, and how can we prioritize monitoring and evaluation, which has been a real Achilles heel, as Mario has been saying, for infection control, human resource development, and then costing, advocacy, and resource mobilization. And what did we hear in Geneva? And we got an earful. We need to update the guidelines and, again, make the guidelines and then the framework very practical. What is a package of action steps? Where can countries begin if they're in a particular, at one level of resources, at another level, at one level of HIV zero prevalence? Depending on the MDR prevalence. So, again, folks want to know how to start. The updated guidelines will take into account the HIV issue, which really wasn't mentioned much, a little bit, but not much in the 1999 guidelines, as well as the MDR issues. I don't think we have any new magical strategies. Again, I wish we did. But I think in terms of our strategies, they're quite what they would have been. The issues are all of these other factors that will enable us to use those strategies and to know where to start and to have some measurable steps. And again, advocacy packages, assessment tools, templates, job aids. Some of these have been in the previous guidelines, and we're updating those because we know there's an urgent need for those. Furthermore, what is needed, I think we heard that, the old idea of, yes, triage patients and, yes, keep the windows open and so on, kind of a cry for much more of a bold approach. Keep people out of the hospital. Let's have a much more aggressive approach to intensify case finding in the community, in HIV service settings of all sorts, ARV programs, voluntary counseling and testing, PMTCT settings, prevention of mother-to-child transmission settings. So let's get these folks while they're in outpatient settings, identify them and get them diagnosed and on treatment before we get into the hospitalization issue, which I think we've heard a number of times, may not be the best option in many of the settings we're working in. stronger laboratory systems. I think we're going to be hearing about that over the next few days. Quality assurance of smear microscopy, fluorescent microscopy culture, lab biosafety, all of these issues are at the one of the key pillars of TB infection control. And so when we look at programs to assess their infection control activities, the lab is one of those that should be looked at. We discussed a bit about the fact that, unfortunately, there's a higher risk of TB infection and disease in healthcare settings. I put up several recent references that describe this in various settings, in the resource-limited settings, and in particular countries, Zimbabwe and Cote d'Ivoire. And I think we know this. With regard to healthcare worker safety, there was a discussion of a much more aggressive approach towards healthcare worker safety, and that in some ways TB could catalyze more of an approach towards healthcare worker safety overall, such as the idea of having annual assessments of all healthcare workers, having a campaign for all healthcare workers to know their HIV status and to address the stigma and all of the issues that are preventing that. Some even suggested, you know, that in some areas, workmen's compensation is given to healthcare workers if they develop TB. A much more aggressive approach to isoniazid preventive therapy in people living with HIV and AIDS, and we just heard that discussion, and the TB-HIV work group has just developed a statement on that. And then mentoring on basic principles. Some of the HIV partners have discussed with us the fact that in some of the settings that they are working in, even the concept of triage is not well accepted or well understood. Patients queue up, and if they're coughing up blood and they're number 15, they're seen after number 14. And so these are some basic issues that need to be worked on. Guidance on renovation, construction of healthcare facilities and prisons was discussed. There are, again, so many large initiatives, both in TB but in HIV treatment programs, which are doing a lot of renovation, a lot of reconstruction, a lot of building in some cases, and guidelines on TB infection control are not really on their list and need to be. I think we've talked about linkage with other infection control activities, and then the desire for rapid implementation. I think we talk a lot about infection control. It makes for good discussion, and there's a real desire to use some good sense but to move forward rapidly. And that is, let's have some demonstration project at the clinic and facility level. Let's, if we need to do some operations research, let's get going on that. Developing the plans, rolling out, and again, monitoring, evaluating, and of course, training. So what are we doing about it? And again, these are our early plans. We are having a work group meeting during this meeting on Sunday the 11th at 12:45 in room 1.62. And I would encourage those of you who are interested to come. We want to hear more from you on what is needed and share what we're doing. First, I think, to form a core team, a working team, and this will include representation and liaise, obviously, with other groups. As been mentioned today, the MDR-TB group. We have a lot to learn from them, and we want to share with them what we learn. The lab group, advocacy, and, of course, DOTS expansion. We are revising these guidelines, and they will include the recently published tuberculosis infection control in the era of expanding HIV care and treatment. So we're going to put these together and make things more simple. These 1999 guidelines we hope to have finished by the first quarter of 2008. They're in review phase now, so they're quite far along. We are also developing a framework, again, similar to the interim policy on TB-HIV, to assist countries in developing their work plans. This, too, will be ready in the first quarter of 2008. there are many groups that have been working before even the working group was established in helping countries with training technical consultants on infection control and in developing national work plans. And there are several workshops planned both later this year and at the beginning of next year. And I mentioned TBCAP and the KNCB, and there are other mechanisms. So there's been quite a bit of work and due to some of the folks that I mentioned in the beginning and the training of national and international consultants. In March, the WHO HIV department will be having a meeting on intensified case finding, isoniazid preventive therapy, and infection control. And without saying the obvious, intensified TB case finding, isoniazid preventive therapy, all of these are in the service of infection control. So these will help us. We hope to sort of launch the two documents that are being finalized at that meeting. From my other hat that I wear working with PEPFAR, the emergency plan, I'm at CDC in Atlanta. We are supporting infection control trainings. This is through USAID workshops, through TBCAP, demonstration projects, working with all of the HIV providers to look at their programs and demonstration projects at facility level, at district level. And in the country operations plans, most of these countries are in sub-Saharan Africa, putting in infection control plans in all of their FY08 activities. So, again, a way to begin to demonstrate activities and sort of spread them out to the HIV community. And, of course, the bottom line is strengthening basic TB dots through the initiatives that you see here. I wish that TB infection control was a quick fix. In the United States, when we had similar problems of MDR and HIV, we had the luxury of a fair amount of resources, certainly for New York City and other areas that were very hard hit. And we were able to get a handle on it. I think it took money, but it also took a lot of focus. And the administrative control measures, again, there have been several papers that mentioned that the work practice measures often made the big difference before the more expensive environmental and personal respiratory protection. But I also want to add that I think a big part of this is going to be advocacy, communication, community mobilization, and I wrote we need to think big, like SARS and avian influenza. These things catapulted attention and got attention to respiratory infections, and I think we can learn from that. We can work with those folks, not only in a fear mongering, but in how to gain appropriate interest. But then I want to close with the fact that we also need to think of all the little things, because it won't help if we just, you know, open the windows on both sides and separate the coffers. Every single worker in every healthcare setting, and of course in prisons too, needs to be aware of the basic issues. So it's training at all levels. And for this one, I think of the hand-washing campaigns. You can go to any airport restroom anywhere in the world, and often you'll see that, you know, must-wash hands. I think we need to think of that as well. So I'll finish with what are you doing, and I hope you'll work with us. Thank you.
Thank you for that wonderful presentation. So may we now call the last speaker to discuss on addressing TB infection control from a country experience, Dr. Martin Jagi from Peru.
I want to thank the organizers of this meeting for the opportunity given to me to show briefly working in infection control that have been done in these past few years in my country. Peru have 28 million of total population, The population living in poverty is the 54%. The TB incidence is more than 100. MDR-TB in new patients, 3%. National HIV prevalence, 0.6%. TB among HIV patients, 30%. HIV in TB patients, 3%. In Peru, we have more than 7,000 health services. Most of them are post centers. This graphic shows that incidence rate of TB has been declining gradually in the last years, but still maintain high rates for the Americas region. This problem in the community is moving inside healthcare facilities. TB transmission in our health services in Peru. Dr. Bonifacio have a study in 2000 made in the Daniel Alcides Carrion Hospital in Callao using tuberculin skin tests between residents measured incidence of TST conversion. Of 98 residents that have been evaluated, 59% had a positive TST before the study. Of 36 residents that were initially negative TST, 6 converted to positive TST. Annual rate of TST conversion, 17%. We have outbreaks too in our hospital. For example, an outbreak in Almenara Hospital in 1997. This hospital have more than 1,000 beds. 44 health workers with TB suspects. The TB incidence before the outbreak was 167. And the TB incidence in 1997 in laboratory was near to 7,000, and in medicine, near to 1,000. In this outbreak, 36 health workers had TB confirmed. Independent risk factor for TB infection in laboratory health worker was the use of common areas. In 2004, 65 DST were processed of equal number of Peruvian health workers from different hospitals and health centers of Peru. Of these 65 DST, near to 11% were MDR. The chronology of infection control in Peru. In the 90s, We organized an improved of national TB program. In 2002, beginning of TB infection control trainings. In 2004, the first guideline of TB infection control in Peru. In 2005, TB infection control plans in 10 health centers and hospitals. 2006, the first course for engineers and architects, and updated TB guidelines. In 2004, Global Fund financed TB infection control plans in 18 hospitals. Beginning in 1998, guidelines and norms were written and approved in general infection control in Peru, like surveillance of nosocomial infection, control and prevention of nosocomial infection, microbiology, sterilization, and waste management. In 2002, we developed a specific guideline for TB infection control, like isolation guidelines, TB infection control for health establishment training model, and technical norm of health for TB control. Training in infection control. 70 hospitals were training in surveillance, control and prevention, isolation, microbiology and sterilization. More than 2,000 health workers were training in general and specific aspects of infection control. We also produce material for infection control trainings like videos, posters, and brochures. Training in infection control for health workers of Lima and Callao incurses two doctors and nurses of TV programs, laboratorians, hospital directors, doctors and nurses of emergency and medicine departments, engineers and architects. The content of those courses include general concepts about TB transmission, administrative controls, environmental controls, and respiratory protection. Time, 3 or 4 days. Implementation of TB infection control plans. TB infection control plans were subsequent to the training courses. We helped to participants to develop a TB infection control plan in the last day of the course and then select the best TB infection control plan. The participants of the course had to identify higher risk areas of their health establishments and draw a plan of their health centers. The criteria for selection the best infection control plans are to include three controls: political commitment of authorities of the hospital, health services that have high rates of TB and MDR, and the amount of money for each TB infection control plan was for health center $5,000. And for hospital, between $15,000 and $20,000. This is San Cosme Health Center, which attends 200 TB patients per day, many of whom are MDR. Before the intervention, had a small waiting area in this first picture. We trained the health worker of this health center, and then they developed a TB infection control plan that includes the transfer of the TB rooms to the second floor of the health center. This is another hospital. This is Loaiza Hospital. In the first picture, show general medicine wards that have TB suspects, patients, and patients with other disease. We train to the health worker of this hospital. They developed the TB infection control plan for their hospital, and then we remodeled 4 respiratory isolation room for these patients. Biosafety in Mycobacterium laboratory. In 1996, National Health Institute of Peru has developed the norms of biosafety for TB laboratory. In 2006, these norms were updated. With the support of the State Laboratory of Massachusetts, courses have been developed to form 35 of biosafety cabinets. TB laboratory networked in Peru have 60 laboratories who process culture and 6 laboratories process DST. Since 2004, were remodeled and or build intermediate laboratories for processing rapid DST, conventional DST, and cultures in Lima, with the following criteria: more than 12 air exchange per hour, negative pressure, functional distribution of the areas. This picture shows an intermediate laboratory for one district of Lima that process DST, rapid DST, conventional DST, and culture. Future activities in TB infection control. The Global Fund TB project has planned infection control activities for 18 hospitals at national level. This includes training for health workers in 18 hospitals, financing the implementation of 18 infection control plans. Infection control in Latin America. Since 2002, Pan American Health Organization promoted some activities on general infection control, and these include the following: elaboration of protocols, technical assistance, and visits of supervision to hospitals. Isolation rooms in Latin American hospitals. In 2006, we evaluated 31 hospitals in 5 countries in Latin America, of Latin America. We used a rapid guideline of Pan American Health Office for infection control. Only 7 hospitals had respiratory isolation room, 23%. Courses, we trained courses in Bolivia, Paraguay, and Ecuador during 2006 and 2007. Next courses in Dominican Republic and Guatemala, 40 participants for each course. These courses included doctors, nurses, and laboratorians of referral hospital of each country. This picture shows the people in Ecuador, of different hospitals in Ecuador, and the second picture shows the chief of the TB MDR department of a referral hospital in Guayaquil, Ecuador. This training included trainers from Peru and CDC. The practice includes administrative controls like identify risk areas for TB transmission, environmental controls like evaluation of natural and mechanical ventilation, measure of airflow and number of air exchange. Respiratory protection include fit tests. This picture shows in Ecuador about fit tests. Lesson learned about guidelines. The existence of local and national guidelines on general aspect of infection control facilitates the introduction of TB infection control measures. It's important to be careful in adopting recommendations of other countries with different prevalence of TB, more resources, etc. In many hospitals, aspects of environmental controls and respiratory protections are prioritized, neglecting the implementation of administrative controls. Frequent rotation of health workers forces to national TB program to have constant training in infection control. It is important to include to engineers and architects who worked in health services in these trainings. In the second picture shows a South African engineer helping us to train our engineers and architects. National TB programs must be able to supervise construction or remodeling TB areas in patient laboratories, not to increase the risk of transmission. Donors not necessarily know about infection control. I want to thank the Peruvian National Tuberculosis Program, Peruvian National Institute of Health, CDC, Paul Jensen, Jacob Creswell, Peter Segalski, Pan American Health Office, Dr. Gabriel Smunish, Ernesto Jaramillo, Partners in Health and Socios en Salud, Jaime Bayona, Harvard Medical School, Brigham and Women's Hospital, Dr. Sonia Shin, and Massachusetts State Laboratory Institute, Dr. Alex Slowski. Thank you very much, and you're welcome to Peru.
So we'd like to invite the speakers on stage, please, to entertain some questions from the floor. Okay, so I think I see one. Yes, please.
Thank you very much to Beth and Martine for their excellent presentations. A couple of comments and questions. That clearly this is, in my opinion, an area that has been neglected for too long, and it's good to see the movement towards implementing infection control precautions. Question I have, Martine, is first, as part of the treatment, I'm sorry, not treatment, the training that you've undertaken, what components of monitoring and evaluation have been part of that? Because I think that a key element to sustain the introduction of these measures over time is going to be to show convincingly that you're going to reduce your TB incidence in your healthcare workers and in your patients. And if you start teaching all these methods, but you don't collect the data, I'm afraid that over time we're going to extinguish the fear and revert back to our default position, which is to neglect the infection control. The other question, Beth, I congratulate you for extending into the other groups. I was recently in a training session for pandemic influenza planning. And I think we also need to do the reciprocal of bringing ourselves to their meetings to help influence these practices. I've seen that they've developed packages for infection control that are very consonant to a lot of the things that we're promoting. Clearly, we don't promote the wearing of gowns, but all the other elements of respiratory protection are there. So in addition to trying to bring them to our table, we need to put ourselves in their media and fora to make sure that we also help influence that process. So inviting you to think about what are the appropriate matrix management opportunities in that regard. Thank you both.
Okay, so may we request to please for the initial response.
Thanks, Dr. Kincastro. indicator for monitoring the infection control activities or trainings. When the infection control committees or teams develop an infection control TB plan, they elaborate indicators. But these indicators, we have to be careful to select the indicator. For example, if you have a hospital like Almendara Hospital with more than 3,000 of health workers, probably one of your indicators will be the number of TB of health workers that develop TB. But if you have this plan in a health center or post center with 50 or 40 health workers, probably this indicator don't function. So in the answer is that yes, when you train a team of health workers, they develop indicators. But we we have to put attention in the type of indicator. When you are in a big hospital, probably you have to select some indicators or some impact indicators. But if you are in a small health center, probably you should select a process indicator.
So for the second question, it's...
I think that was a question. I think it was a comment.
Okay. So are there any questions from the floor? Yes, please.
Thank you very much, Bess Miller, for your presentation on the infection control, the sub-working group. It answered all my questions, but I want to bring it down to where we are working, the dilemmas we're facing. How do you, in a setting where there's stealing of locks and from windows and doors, and they have to end up welding the windows so that they stop stealing, in a TB hospital, they're tired of replacing them. What do you do in an MD, when you have an MDR patient in a TB hospital or your facility where you have diagnosed the patient and the MDR hospital is full and you have to wait for beds, so you keep the patient where you diagnosed him? What do you do where the weather conditions do not allow, it's cold, and when you open the windows, the patients close the windows? And then also the space issue. Most of the clinics are small. They were built years ago. Now we have so many patients, and we have nowhere to, there's no space at all, so you end up putting up a park home or a container, and the way it was designed was not infection control friendly. If you have 10 of them, what do you do? Thank you.
I wish I had an answer for those questions. I think the sort of the quick and the easy answer is in for climates that allow for it, to have as much outside waiting areas with an awning cover as possible. With regard to housing MDR patients, I know in our community many years back we had trailers that our patients were living in. So each community comes up with a makeshift answer, I'm afraid. In cold weather climates as well, it depends on how cold. In some of the areas in Africa, we often say, well, give people more blankets and sweaters and still have windows open. I don't think that obtains in Siberia. So each one of these demands some thought and answer, and they really are problems. And some of these patients feel like pariahs. People will put them at the very end of a hospital as far, you know, downwind as possible. But it's a challenge.
Okay, may we have the next question from the gentleman there?
Yes, Peter Daly, CMC Vellore, South India. We work in a very privatized system, and the cost and consequence of a nosocomial TBN transmission is borne by the patient himself. And so we go to the administration and we say we want more funds to do something about preventing nosocomial transmission, and the administration says, why? Because the patient is the one to pay for that cost. How do we respond to that?
To whom are you addressing the question, sir? To
any of the speakers.
Okay. Ladies first, please.
Well, it's a matter of educating, isn't it? It's a matter of having a sense in an area that infection control isn't one person's or one patient's responsibility. It's a systems approach. And I know that just sounds like another word, but I think I really believe it. When we say political will and advocacy and communications and so on, that's what we're talking about. We're going to need to sensitize a variety of persons, including hospital administrators, of the overall issue and how a strong TB lab is TB infection control, and how the ability to separate and triage is part of infection control, and that it's not the one patient that happened to be seen as an index case in any one outbreak. But again, these are challenges, but these are areas that we want to address.
Probably the answer of a question, what could we do when a director of a hospital give that kind of answer. We have this problem with general infection control, not only in TB. The directors, they don't put money in infection control. And we only wait for outbreaks like flu, avian flu, SARS, no? And really, these outbreaks are opportunities for the people who works for us, who works in infection control. So the journalists have some titles in the newspapers, so give us the opportunity to the people that work in TB, in respiratory infections, to have more money. But it's one strategy is to train the directors. Yes, in a practical way. Yeah, because probably this director is a surgeon, a neurosurgeon, and this is the practical and the reality. And you have to talk with a surgeon, or you have to talk with a traumatologist. No, or you have to talk. You have look if you talk with a director that is an epidemiologist, no. But one way is to train, and probably you have to first train to the directors before the practical doctors.
Thank you very much for that wonderful answer, sir. So may we call on the next, please?
Thank you very much,
son. Harry Friedland from Yale and Tugela Ferry. First of all, this was a wonderful session, and it's terrific to see infection control rising up to the place where it needs to be in the midst of drug-resistant tuberculosis and HIV. My compliments to the organizers for doing that. I think in addition to getting to the directors, we need to figure out how to make infection control sexy and seductive. And that is really a challenge. But when you do speak with people about it, the eyes roll and the fingers sort of, you know, twiddle, and people try to leave the room. So there has to be some way of encouraging enthusiasm, and it, I think, that requires a different kind of approach, and it really is one of marketing and figuring out ways of conveying the message in a way that is I think more interesting and more gripping than and more seductive, really, in the way that generally it's been approached by healthcare professionals. And I think we need some message professionals actually to move this message along. It is really a structural, behavioral issue. I don't think they're going to be dramatically new infection control strategies. It's just a question of implementing the ones that we already have. So we need to put on the team, actually, people who understand behavior, I think, better than many of us do, including institutional behavior. I wanted to make a comment about monitoring and evaluation, because that's critical also, and something that now, entering into this field, I think, and others are struggling with, and that is how do you actually demonstrate the benefits of infection control strategies. And that is a really complicated issue, because as was mentioned, largely the way it's going to be is through process measures, which are not terribly convincing. So I want to advocate for other types of creative ways of looking at outcomes, including things like mathematical modeling, which I know generally are not accepted as fact, but we're not going to have randomized controlled trials. We're unlikely to have major observational studies that show impact. So we really have to use other strategies and other techniques that that can demonstrate benefit of individual or combinations of infection control strategies with available information. And I would just point out the study in The Lancet that was published a week ago that my colleagues and I were able to put together, that I think demonstrate that even in the midst of the worst, what we think is nosocomial transmission, TB, drug-resistant HIV epidemic in the world, and that is here in South Africa. With the proper array of infection control strategies existing and available within a resource-limited context, it is possible to reduce or to avert 50% of the likely infections that will happen in the hospital setting in the next 5 years. So creative ways, really, of approaching this issue, both in terms of advocacy, of getting the message across, and also measuring it, I think, are very much needed.
Okay, so no response from our speakers? Yes, Bess, please.
Yes, I just wanted to thank Jerry, and it's only the fact that I know you that I won't take it personally that you're commenting that once again I'm working on something that is not sexy or seductive. Thanks, Jerry.
So may we ask the fellow behind, please?
Thank you very much. I'm Lovett Lawson from Nigeria. One of the most important aspects of infectious control is to have a very good and reliable lab. And to have this, you require EQAs, EQCs, and external quality control centers to supervise these laboratories. How many do we have in the world? Let's say I come from Nigeria. I want to have a quality control center look into what we're doing in our labs. I have to come to South Africa. How costly are these? What should be done to make it possible for centers to have good quality control, good external quality assurance and external quality control? Thank you.
So would you like to respond?
Are you talking about quality control in laboratory or?
Yeah.
I think there's two matters, no? In laboratory, in infection control, we need to be to have opportunity and quality, no? And the first is the opportunity. For example, if you are inside in emergency department in a hospital, if your laboratory gives the result of your bacilloscopy 2 days later, probably the health worker in the emergency department have more risk if you compare with another hospital that the laboratories laboratorians give the results in 1 hour. The first part is the opportunity in laboratory. The second, obviously, is the quality of the result, of the bacilloscopy, of the DST, of the culture. And the opportunity is, for example, for DST, the rapid DST is another thing that I really don't talk much, but we in Peru, we develop with the help of Massachusetts State Laboratory and CDC, the GRIES method. I don't know if I go to another way, but that's my answer.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I think it feels like the entire week that the laboratory is an underlying theme. And again, of course, the laboratory sub-working group and many other initiatives are focusing on strengthening TB labs, without which you obviously can't have a good TB infection control program.
Okay, so thank you for those responses. I think the last two will be coming from the lady behind, then Dr. Ken Castro, and then finally the gentleman at the back, please.
Thank you. Jane Carter from Moi University AMPATH program in Eldoret, Kenya, and Brown University. And I really just came best to congratulate the working group on thinking so broadly and including things like active case finding in the community as part of infection control. I think this is something I struggle with my colleagues, that we can do early screening when patients come into the ward, and we can get masks, and we can do something about infection control there. But we've really let down our healthcare workers when we send them back to their communities with no infection control. So I applaud the working group in thinking so broadly about community active case finding.
Thanks, Ed. I just wanted to add to the question that was asked a while ago about how do you convince the decision makers, and I need to acknowledge that in the United States, a lot of what we were prompted to do came because of the wrath that was unleashed during the outbreaks in the early 1990s by healthcare worker unions who demanded to be protected, and by the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, better known as ACT UP, doing protests. In fact, I have two slides that I usually carry with me to show that, you know, they were actively demonstrating in front of the health department saying, we don't want our people dying in these places where we come, and we don't want us as healthcare workers to succumb. So we need to also bring that sense of outrage in the community that's most affected to influence those individuals. You know, we can say this until we're blue in our faces, but we need to create that demand. And that's the other area that we need to start unleashing again.
So there are no response from the speakers. I think we invite the last speaker, and for those who have other questions, you may just kindly approach the speakers personally. So the gentleman behind, please.
Thank you. I'm Emmanuel Okiri from Nigeria. My question is on getting some information. Let me give you the scenario, the reason for my for requesting for the information. Even amongst health workers, doctors and nurses and other colleagues, if we are on a queue, because I work in a center, maybe known majorly for management of TB cases, if we are on a queue, maybe getting information or filling forms, and you want to get first, maybe you came late and you want to be in front as fast as possible, all you have to do is, I work at so-so-so place. And you see your colleagues move to the side, they say, you can quickly go so that you leave this place. So I'm interested in having data to either support their action or disapprove their action. Thank you.
Character management. Would you like to respond? Okay, would you like to respond? Okay, I think that's a well-acknowledged comment from the gentleman. So I think at this point in time, we need to close the session because we have also other things to follow after this, and I think this afternoon has really been quite productive in the sense that we have been shared with experiences from various countries and the important aspects of IPT, MDR-TB, XDR-TB management, as well as that of infection control has been raised up. So I'd like to thank also my co-chair, all the speakers, and the organizers of this afternoon session, and of course you as participants. Thank you.